Okay, mein Name ist Walter Thiel. I'm from the Max Planck Institute für Kohlenforschung in Mülheim, Germany. It's an institute that does catalysis research, essentially with four experimental and one theoretical department. My scientific background is quantum chemistry of molecules. So we are interested in the structure, the stability, the spectra of molecules, and particularly their reactivity, the making and breaking of chemical bonds, which is at the heart of chemistry. And therefore, we have to do electronic structure theory to understand this reactivity. So the basic theory behind is quantum mechanics, of course, and our central working equation is the Schrödinger equation. So I'll start out with a blackboard talk and we'll then switch to some presentation later on. So we would start out with time-independent Schrödinger equation using, as a Hamilton operator, kinetic energy plus potential energy Coulomb interactions. And then we use von Oppenheimer approximation to decouple nuclear and electronic motion. And we arrive at the electronic Schrödinger equation. And this we solve, and in order to get potential energy surfaces for the electronic ground state, maybe also for excited states. And this is essentially, you know, where we extract the knowledge about chemistry. So our core business is essentially solving this equation in quantum chemistry. So the I plan to do, I mean, Kurt told me I should give an overview over things, and I understand that not everybody of you is a real specialist in quantum chemistry. So I will try to sort of outline the quantum chemistry framework a little bit and also try to tell you where then multiscale methodology comes in. So the centerpiece of
So just ask stupid questions.
Sure.
Are there any examples of the modern Bohr-Oppenheimer is important? Or?
We'll be late in the talk. This is always a good answer. So the centerpiece of quantum chemistry is ab initio quantum chemistry. Let me put that here. And in the standard ab initio treatments, you have 2 degrees of freedom. One's the method that you are using, and the other one is the basis set. The one electron basis set in which you expand your wave function. And the starting point in ab initio quantum chemistry is Hartree-Fock approximation. So there you have the ansatz for the n electron wave function in terms of one electron functions, in terms of orbitals, Slater determinants. And then you solve for the for these orbitals by variation theory, Hartree-Fock equations. And the 1 degree of freedom that you have is the basis set, which you use to expand your orbitals in. And there is sort of a systematic series of basis sets. If you use Gaussian, you would start with STO3G, sort of a minimum basis set, with one basis function per 1s, 2s, 2p atomic orbital. Then you would go next step to some double zeta polarized basis. And then the quantum chemists love acronyms. They become longer and longer. Something like that, for example, etc. And the ab initio people, sort of the pure people, they have their own consistent set of valence correlated, correlation consistent basis sets. And this starts out basically with the double zeta augmented. And then triple zeta augmented. I have to extend this line. Quadruple zeta, quintuple zeta, and so on. And then at the end, you are at the basis set limit, the complete basis set limit. This is, in terms of basis set, the holy grail. And there are well-defined extrapolation procedures nowadays when you've done triple zeta, quadruple zeta, maybe pentuple zeta calculations, where you can extrapolate with controlled numerical error to the complete basis set limit.
Does it matter that we have no idea what those things are?
I think it doesn't matter really. It's Gaussian functions, basically, what you use. You basis set.
The functions are centered on atoms. Meaning, we ask if your basis set is overcomplete or if it is. If it has dependencies, etc., is there an easy answer to
all these issues are well under control. I mean, this is the whole industry, basis set generation. Quantum chemists have done that since 40 years. And there are well-established basis sets with well-known quality that you can just pick by a keyword in a program. Essentially, as was said, you know, you have atom-centered basis functions because you want to represent your wave function for the whole molecule in terms of atomic components, which makes sense because from crystallography, you know, for example, that the electron density of a molecule is to a good approximation 98% or so superimposed from atomic densities. And so it makes sense to have such an atomic orbital linear combination. And then it's a technical question, you know, how you best represent the atomic orbitals, the basis functions, and they're the proper choice is Gaussians, usually, for computational efficiency.
But this notation, ADC, ADC, is it another notation for Gaussian systems?
No.
Or it's just another system?
It is also Gaussian orbitals. Double D, the important thing is DZ, double zeta, triple zeta, quadruple zeta, which means how many basis functions you have for one 1s orbital or 2s or 2p orbital. So the more you have, the more zetas you have, the bigger is the variational flexibility that the variational method can use to sort of adapt the wave function. So the higher you go in this series, the closer you get to the complete basis set limit.
But my question was, is a different function. It's not a function like in 6031, 6011.
The mathematical form is always a Gaussian function. The way the exponents are defined and the contraction coefficients are defined is specific to a given basis, yeah.
Is it not just to represent the cusp, the Slater? Because you need the cusp and that you don't get with the Gaussian, so you need several Gaussians to have something which looks like a cusp. And
it has to do with that, of course, in the correlated functions.
That you can do with two. That means the double zeta means two.
Double zeta means two Gaussians. Typically, three triple zeta typically gives you a very good representation of a SDO already, if you wish to do that. Yeah. It's a matter of, you know, compromising between computational efficiency and accuracy of the expansion, something that has occupied quantum chemists for a long time. And basically, you need more Gaussians to get the same quality, but you can do the calculations with more Gaussians better than with less Slaters. Yeah.
Are the properties known of how you converge to this complete basis set limit, that you know how to extrapolate?
Right.
That's important.
That's known. You know, there are well-established formulas how to do the extrapolation of the complete basis set limit. Okay, this was just the Hartree-Fock limit. And Hartree-Fock gives you typically 98% of the total energy. So at first sight, it is not bad at the complete basis set limit. But if you do chemistry, the remaining 2%, which are huge numbers, you know, they vary quite a bit, you know, if you do a reaction, for example. So Hartree-Fock is not good enough for quantitative computations.
Tell me what I'm missing if I do Hartree-Fock but a complete basis set.
Say again?
What am I missing when I do Hartree-Fock but a complete basis set?
So Hartree-Fock is a mean field theory. And so the electron at every instant in time just experiences the field of the nuclei at certain positions and the mean field of all other electrons.
Well, I thought this is a variational answer. It's a nice thought. It's a complete Turing equation.
This is as you have explained yourself a few days ago how the mean field can be derived from Gibbs Bodolinov.
So,
other big function, etc.
Well, you said you solved the Schrödinger equation.
No, this
apparently you don't solve the Schrödinger equation. No, Hartree-Fock isn't an exact solution.
He does that in the mean field there.
Well, you see. We would have to have complete flexibility in the n-electron wave function to solve the Schrödinger equation. That is the next topic, basically. What you do in Hartree-Fock is that you have an ansatz for the n-electron wave function, which is an anti-symmetrized product of one-electron wave functions.
Okay, so it's a then again.
Yeah, anti-symmetrized because of the Pauli principle. Okay. And the correlations are just not there, yeah?
Okay, so it's just singles later.
Yeah, and so basically you just do the convergence here at the complete basis set limit with regard to the orbitals, not with regard to the n-electron wave function. And this basically is the second axis here, that you now have to care about the remaining 2% correlation, electron correlation. And there is a hierarchy of methods, again, how to do that. So you start out with the simplest method, MP2, which is Müller-Blessert perturbation theory, second order. And then you can become successively better. So the next established step would be coupled cluster theory, singles and doubles. And then the next one would be CCSDT with triple excitations included. And the Holy Grail is then full CI, which gives you the exact solution then of the correlation problem. Now, what are these things? What you do basically in all the correlation treatments is that you start out from a Hartree-Fock determinant, and then you allow admixtures of excited configurations, which you get by exciting 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on electrons from the ground state determinant into virtual unoccupied orbitals. Because here you get in this Hartree-Fock treatment for n electrons, closed shell system, n half doubly occupied orbitals and many, many unoccupied orbitals. And these unoccupied orbitals you can use to generate excited configurations, which are orthogonal to the Hartree-Fock determinant and which you can mix into the Hartree-Fock determinant in these correlation treatments.
What does the existence of an excited electron have to do with correlations?
Well, what you want to do basically is improve your wave function, the Hartree-Fock wave function that you have. Now, the Hartree-Fock wave function is variational and is for the ansatz single Slater determinant is just optimum. You can't do anything anymore. So you can improve it by adding components that are orthogonal to it. And now you have to think about how to generate these orthogonal components that give you more flexibility, you know, to adapt the wave function to the correlation problem. And it is natural in that scheme, basically, that you use these orthogonal components for improvement, that you take them from the orbitals that you have, namely that you do excitations, new n-electron configurations, by sort of exciting an electron from occupied to an unoccupied orbital. This just generates more basis functions for an n-electron treatment, now for a correlation treatment.
Basically, you need to avoid having the products.
Well, you do a linear combination in the end, in the psi electronic. Well, let's call that psi. And this is sort of the thing that you want. And these are n electron wave functions, or n electron configurations.
Okay, sort of. The linear combination of product state is not necessarily a product state.
No. Yeah. This here you have an orthogonal basis. Hartree-Fock configuration is the dominant configuration there. And then you generate for the purpose of this expansion all sorts of extra n electron wave functions that you get by these excitations into unoccupied orbitals. And then you have a new n electron basis. And then you do a new variational treatment, essentially, that would be configuration interaction, to determine these coefficients. And then you get a better n electron wave function, which incorporates correlations.
So you don't also need to worry about spatial correlations even without excitations? Does that make sense in this context?
Well, you include spatial correlations in this manner because you have sort of a different, you know, distribution of the electrons in space, you know, by these additional basis functions for the n-electron treatment. Yeah.
So you're saying that without excitation, there's no need to worry about spatial correlations?
No, the excitations are just a means to generate the basis functions here for this variational n electron treatment. You could do, if you are smart, you know, you could find other basis functions of n electron kind to do this correlation treatment. But what everybody in the world does is use these excited configurations for that purpose.
Yeah? Where would you put quantum Monte Carlo in that?
It's not in that scheme. It's a different brand.
Oh, I understand it's a different brand, but in terms of accuracy, how would you compare with quantum chemical method? Because it's still a quantum chemical method. It still normally relies on a Gaussian basis set.
The quantum Monte Carlo has the problem with the nodes because it has to know where in the fermion problem where to put the nodes in the quantum Monte Carlo. And if you look at the quantum Monte Carlo literature, they are really good, you know, for systems that have no nodes. And there you can essentially numerically solve the Schrödinger equation. Once you have nodes in the system, which is almost all systems in chemistry, you have to make a choice where the nodes are. And then a normal quantum Monte Carlo does that basically by just starting from a quantum chemistry method and putting the nodes somewhere and maybe variationally optimizing the nodes and so on. And so this has been around since the 70s in quantum chemistry and never has made it to the mainstream, which basically tells me, you know, that it's not competitive with the standard methods. Yeah.
But there could be solid state?
I'm less an expert in solid state, but I wonder whether how competitive they are. I don't know. Any more questions? Yeah.
And how about DFT?
Yeah, comes next, yeah. So I just wanted to show you first sort of the conceptual framework. And I mean, the discussion has shown that already. You have to be careful in sort of having these two axes separate from each other in your mind, yeah? So this is the one electron axis, the basis set, that determines ultimately the flexibility of your wave function. And this is the n electron basis, which is responsible for handling the correlation problem. And now experience shows that there are preferred combinations. So Hartree-Fock, you can get reasonable results already with a relatively modest basis function, because Hartree-Fock converges relatively quickly with the one electron basis. If you go MP2, you want to be here, basically, at least. It's always good to have a better basis. But in practice, you know, you can get by with that for standard accuracy with these combinations. Mm-hmm. For a coupled cluster, you want to have quadruple zeta quality of the basis. And if you are a purist, you want to be up here. This is heaven, basically, because this is the exact solution of the time-independent Schrödinger equation. And this, I think, is a difference from what we have seen, what I have seen in the first week of the talks, because you were always worrying, you know, what is the right answer? So quantum chemistry would say, this is the right answer. If you converge the problem ab initio with regard to the one electron, the n electron problem, then you get the right answer. And if I have time, I will show you examples of that later on. Of course, in parentheses, I should say, this is still a simplification. There's relativity, for example, which would be a third axis, which I haven't treated here. So this is mainly for sort of light elements, the whole thing. And then there are non-Born Oppenheimer effects and things like that. So if you are looking really into the details, you have to worry about heaven a little bit also. But in principle, you know, we can converge in the ab initio way. We can converge the results to the right answer. Question?
If I would do MP4, is that competitive with...
MP4 is an approximation to CCSD. It's the first iteration of a CCSD calculation, and it's out of favor nowadays. So this is the most cost-effective MP2, most cost-effective correlation treatment, and I should maybe give you scaling numbers. Formally, Hartree-Fock would scale like n to the fourth, MP2 like n to the fifth, CCSD n to the sixth, n to the seventh, and this is exponential, n being the number of electrons in the problem or the number of basis functions, more or less the same thing. So quantum chemistry is always a compromise between, you know, the computational effort and the accuracy that you can have. And so this is a good compromise for ground states. And this here is normally called, nowadays, the gold standard, yeah? Because over and over again, for ground state properties, a couple of cluster CCSD parentheses D has been shown to be very good and very precise. In 10 years, of course, you know, we will probably have CCSD TQ, you know, because you can go up the ladder, basically, as the computational things improve.
So how do you know that it's precise when you compare
it? Experiment. In the end, but there are two things. You first look at the intrinsic conversion of the ab initio calculations, and you will see that if you go from one level, so if you move up here, the increments become smaller and smaller as you go on. So this would be an intrinsic way of converging things. And then the end, you look at experiment, of course, yeah.
Can you use experimental numbers to say, I mean, I know something about my system, and that could save me a lot of trouble doing calculations?
This is not the ab initio philosophy, but it is the philosophy that underlies much of current DFT and also much of semi-empirical, or all of semi-empirical work. So these are the next brands now that I would, with your permission, now go towards. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell us what are the typical target size for the masses in terms of how many electrons you can treat?
Okay. With the conventional ways of doing things, I would say gold standard, decent basis, 5 to 10 atoms. MP2, you can do nowadays 100 atoms. Hartree-Fock, several hundred atoms. Yeah. That's sort of typical, you know, without undue effort, yeah?
Okay.
only the Wilhelm selectors, or?
Normally these are all electron treatments, and the correlation is normally only done in the valence shell, because for chemical purposes the core shell correlation is reasonably constant along a reaction path, for example. That's the normal way of doing it. Okay, then we have DFT as the second big brand. This of course came from physics into quantum chemistry, and the quantum chemists have resisted for quite a while to pick that up, but in the end, you know, DFT was such, or is such, a good method that it's now actually the workhorse in quantum chemistry, I would say. And in DFT, you have the same issues about one electron basis set. You have the same also methods to converge to the complete basis set limit in DFT, no problem. So DFT has a different hierarchy, because as you know, in DFT, one looks at the one electron density rather than the n electron wave function as the central quantity that you want to determine, which is an enormous reduction in complexity, of course, because you just have three variables to worry about instead of three n variables to worry about. And this rests, of course, on the Hohenberg-Kohn theorem, Walter Kohn, founding father of this institute or so, who had this famous 1964 theorem that basically tells us that the energy of a non-degenerate ground state system is a functional of the one electron density. And 1 year later with Kohn-Cham, he formulated a practical way of doing such calculations that has many similarities with the Hartree-Fock methodology. Now in the DFT, as you know, there is sort of this magic exchange correlation functional, which includes all non-classical two electron interactions, exchange plus correlation, and also a correction for kinetic energy approximations that are made in the Kohn-Cham approach. And so this functional is sort of the thing that people have been worrying about since many, many years, you know, because in principle there should be an exact functional which gives you the exact solution of the Schrödinger equation, but nobody knows it, you know. So basically, you start out at the simplest level with a local density approximation, where basically you only take sort of the density itself, you know, into account in the functional. This is what the solid state physicists have done over decades, and very successfully so, because in a solid, in a metal, for example, you have a more or less homogeneous electron system, and so it makes sense, you know, that that is a successful approach. In chemistry, in molecules, the density decays exponentially, you know, if you go away from the nucleus, hydrogen atom, for example, or also in general for molecular systems. So having a homogeneous density as sort of the sole determinant might be not so good. So for chemistry, the breakthrough was the generalized gradient approximations that came about in the 1980s, worked by Axel Becker and John Perdue, basically, where the functional is formulated in terms not only of the electron density in itself, but also in terms of the gradient of the electron density, which gives you more flexibility, of course, you know, to represent, you know, what's going on in the molecule. And now there has been something that is called Jacob's ladder nowadays. There are meta GGAs around. This is just sort of a normal extension, or easy extension of that, by taking into account when you formulate the function electron density, its first and its second derivative. And then there are hybrid GGAs, or hybrid functionals. Hybrid GGA is the normal thing, where you basically borrow from Hartree-Fock theory. In a sense, it's a linear combination between Hartree-Fock theory and DFT, because you mix in some kind of Hartree-Fock exchange. It's a bit magic, I would say, because the exchange is not 100% right in these DFTs, and it becomes better if you include some Hartree-Fock exchange. And then there are the double hybrids, which came up recently, where you also mix in some MP2 correlation, just sort of having more and more composite methods that borrow from ab initio quantum chemistry, where DFT is not so good. This suggests a hierarchy, but the sad fact is, in my opinion, you know, that there is no convergent path to the right answer. This is, in my opinion, the biggest difference from ab initio quantum chemistry. Here we have a convergent path to the right answer. Here, on average, if you do statistical evaluations, things tend to become better if you go up here, but there's no guarantee that you will sort of converge to the right answer. And there are quite a few outliers, and there's lots of empiricism involved, picking, you know, what is right.
In some sense, this is not really a strategy. It's just a description of my willingness of what I'm prepared to put in my exchange
right.
relation. It doesn't tell me what that function is yet.
Right.
At every level, I could make different choices.
And there are many people who do different choices there. So I would guess there are certainly 100 functionals around nowadays by different groups. You know, there's heavy competition. And I'm personally, I mean, we've participated in that in the 1990s a little bit, sort of making our own functional. But I sort of got out of that because it's number fitting in the end. You know, it's I don't see too much physics in it. So I think the most common functional is B3LYP, which is around since 1993. And this is the majority of chemistry calculations that is done with that functional. It is sort of good accuracy and limited effort. But if you look at the statistical evaluations nowadays, there are many more there are other functionals which offer higher accuracy in a statistical sense. But whether they are always better, sort of for describing chemical phenomena, I would have a question mark there. So the standard, what I would say the mainstream way of doing DFT in molecular quantum chemistry is to use GGA, which are quite efficient for geometry optimization, something like BP86, for example, an old functional, which gives good geometries. And then you do energies at the B3-lib level. You can also optimize at the B3-lib level, for example. These are the prevalent things. In terms of computational effort, formally all these are n to the 4. This one is n to the 5 because it has some MP2 component in it. And so they are fast. And this, I think, is sort of the, why are they the workhorse in quantum chemistry nowadays? What you essentially do is a Hartree-Fock calculation with this exchange correlation functional, which is sort of a technical detail, if you wish. It's the same type of SCF. The integrals are the same. The basis sets are the same, et cetera, et cetera. So it's more or less the cost of a Hartree-Fock calculation. And by virtue of having these magic functionals, you get electron correlation built into your orbitals in an average sense. So that is my interpretation. You do a Hartree-Fock calculation with the average correlation effects built into it. This makes it fast, it makes it robust, and it works in practice reasonably well. But you are never assured that it's right, and you don't know really how to improve the results.
Is there any way to take these things as a starting point for that issue, or is this impossible?
That's often done, yeah. It's often done, yeah. I mean, what people often do in practice is start out at the DFT level to get an idea what's going on, and then go zoom in and use more accurate methods. You can even use DFT orbitals in correlation treatments, because then you have part of the correlation already built in, and then the correlation treatment converges faster. There are all sorts of mixtures in there.
Yeah. Do the functionals that are chosen have any sort of theoretical basis, or are they must always sort of empirically experimented with just to like get data, right?
There are two schools, basically. One school is John Perdue, for example, who says, I don't want parameters. And what they do is basically just look at general properties like normalization of the exchange hall, asymptotic limits, and what have you. There are a number of formal properties that you can prove. And they construct their functional such that these formal properties are fulfilled. And then there is the other school, and probably Don Trula is the main proponent of that, that says, yeah, we take these as guidelines, you know, these formal things, but then we put in a few parameters here and there, and then we fit against the experimental data. And the most successful Trula functional, MO6 something or so, Minnesota 2006, they have of the order of 30 parameters in them. So it's heavy fitting, and it's nowadays people say it's the best semi-empirical methods that are around because they are really fitted well. You pay a price, you know, because sometimes you have very strange outliers if you use these methods, you know, because then if you go outside the domain of the fitting, then you may be in trouble. More questions for DFT?
Are the functionals equally good for SPDF orbitals, or is it dependent?
That's not an issue, really. The basis set requirements are small, so you get close to the CBS limit already with triple zeta or so. You can use the same basis sets, not a problem. Yeah.
And if you use pseudopotentials, it's not.
It can also be combined with pseudopotentials. It's done all the time. Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Okay. Then there is a third development. Development is wrong. A third historical thing, where one basically thought, we want to simplify the ab initio treatments and go semi-empirical.
Yeah.
these were sort of the most popular methods 1960s, 70s, 80s, because of obvious hardware constraints. You could only do chemistry if you do a lot of integral approximations. So these are essentially simplifications of the Hartree-Fock framework by throwing away many, many integrals and then putting in parameters to compensate for that. And there is also a hierarchy in terms of methods. It's all sort of minimal basis, minimal valence basis in these methods. But there is sort of a hierarchy here that you start out with simple one electron Hückel, and then you have the various NDO methods. These are always, and then OMX methods. So these are distinguished by how many integrals you throw away. Here you only keep one electron integrals, so that's very radical. Here you keep the main two electron integrals, but not all of them. But I don't want to go into detail. This is too much of sort of a specialty, I think. So the methods that are mostly used here, I would say, is AM1 and here OM2. And these are all formulated in Hartree-Fock terms for ground state applications. So these are usually SCF methods. Well, Hückel is not even SCF because you don't have two electron integrals. And then if you want to do electronically excited states, there are CI methods around that you can use for these purposes, basically. And one thing that I have not mentioned here, because it would complicate things, but for the sake of completeness, I should do that, is that all this nice systematics works well if the Hartree-Fock determinant or the Cohn-Shannon determinant is a reasonably good zero-order description of the system, which is the case in many, which is very often the case if you have ground state molecules, almost always. But if you look at the transition state in the chemical reaction, or if you look in electronically excited state, often the electronic structure can no longer be described to zero order well by such a single configuration, but you have multi-configuration problems right away, because there is no one set of orbitals that is good enough to describe that. H2 dissociation is the simplest textbook example for that. And then there are variants of all these methods that are based on multi-reference descriptions. This would then become CAS-SCF, this would become CAS-PD2, and here we would have multi-reference CI and multi-reference coupled cluster methods around. But I don't want to go into these details. So we already had the question, how big can we go? So in our group, we are interested in molecules ranging, say, from 2 atoms to 50,000 atoms. So basically, we use all these methods that are here on the blackboard, depending on the type of problem we are looking at in our group. And for a quantum chemist, you know, the natural inclination is, you know, go as close as here for as large a system as you can do. And of course, you know, you run into a brick wall sooner or later. So here you run into a brick wall relatively early. But even with DFT, you run into brick walls. So if you want to do an enzyme, for example, biocatalysis by an enzyme, one of the applications we are after, we have to think, how can we extend these methods to really large systems? And so there are two strategies, essentially. One strategy that applies to all of them. You can do that at ab initio level, DFT level, semi-empirical level, is do linear scaling. This is something that has seen many activities over the past 20 years. And the idea is basically to reformulate the algorithms that we use in these quantum chemical programs such that you make use of the locality of interactions and that you throw away in a large enzyme all the negligible interactions that are there in a straightforward implementation in a numerically controlled manner. So this is the whole purpose. It must be numerically controlled, that you basically can say, when I apply linear scaling in a certain way, then I know how large the remaining error is. And such methods have been, as I said, developed for this whole series of, or for this whole diversity of computational methods. Don't want to go into detail at this point. This is one strategy, much activity.
Doesn't it sound a bit like this local entity approximation? I hear the same spirit.
You hear the same word, but it's something different, yeah.
Yeah, but in the sense that you say it's only local things that matter, and
yeah.
And that concentrate on.
Yeah. let me give you an example. You know, if you do a local correlation treatment, for example, then if you think about these excited configurations that I talked about, you know, that give you flexibility for the n-electron problem, you can basically do the configuration interaction treatment by allowing excitations in enzyme from here to over here, and that doesn't give you any contribution to the energy or to the wave function. So a local correlation treatment would say we localize all the orbitals, and we just sort of allow excitations in a local domain. And then you show by careful work, you know, that you get 99 point so and so many percent of the correlation energy at that level when you do that in a numerically controlled manner. This is the basic idea behind linear scaling, and it has nothing to do with local density approximation here. Yeah.
Just to make sure I don't misunderstand this, but GTA is also local.
It's also local, yeah. All these are local. These are all, well, these are local, and then it starts to become non-local here because Hartree-Fock exchange is non-local, yeah?
So van der Waals interactions would be part of B3-Lib?
No, B3-Lib doesn't have van der Waals. The double hybrids have it because you use MP2, but only to some extent. Dispersion van der Waals has been a big problem with DFT, which has been largely ignored. The way it's handled nowadays is basically by empirical phosphor type corrections, which are put on top of DFT and which work pretty well, yeah. Okay, this is the one strategy that one has, linear scaling. Lots of effort. So what you can do then is linear scaling, the couple
cluster, the gold standard stuff.
You can extend to 50 atoms rather than 10. So you're still far away from enzyme. DFT, you can probably go to 1,000 atoms, which is reasonably large, but still not an enzyme. And so you push the limits with linear scaling, but it remains expensive. And so the other strategy is a multi-scale strategy. This is QMMM. And this is, I think, what has become the method of choice for things like enzymes, because it has a different strategy. It basically says, I do not insist on doing the whole problem at one level of accuracy, which you do with linear scaling, where you would do sort of a DFT or semi-empirical calculation for the whole enzyme. But you say, my chemistry is such that there are important parts where the reaction happens, for example, or where I have a photoexcitation, and there's an active site, which I should describe fairly well at a high quantum level. And there is sort of stuff around which influences the reaction but is not really essential. Because if you think of an enzyme, the whole protein environment has two major functions. One, it provides steric constraints, some type of skeleton, you know, where, you know, things have to fit in. And the other thing is electrostatics, where you basically have polar surroundings of an active site, which influence the wave function in the active site. And these two main effects of the surrounding you can include at phosphate level. And this has been sort of shown over and over again in many, many examples. So that basically the difference between these two approaches is here we want to do the whole system at a uniform level. Here we basically say we do probably high-level quantum where it counts in the active site, but we don't throw away the environment, but in a multi-scale sense include the environment at a lower level. And of course there are many, many, you know, methodological developments in that area to make that work.
You have described these basis sets, and if I hear this, then I think, well, can I use sloppy basis sets somewhere outside and be very precise in the middle and then still use this framework? Is that...
You can do that, but people have tried it, and it was not very productive because basis set imbalance sort of screws up the variational treatment. Yeah, it can be done, but it's less efficient than something like that, you know. Here you gain, I mean, there have been comparisons, you know, single point calculations, linear scaling versus this one here. And this is orders of magnitude faster, and it's more accurate where it counts. So I think the bottom line is that this multi-scale approach wins out.
What does the acronym stand for? What does the acronym stand for?
Quantum mechanics, molecular mechanics. So this is another word for force field, yeah?
Does that go most natural with the DFT methods or the... I mean, with molecular mechanics, you in principle have electron density, so that would say that's what you need in DFT.
Yeah. It goes with all variants, you know. The standard thing nowadays is to start with a DFT MM and see how far you get with that. So it matches up well with DFT.
But
the hybrid is always between a quantum and a classical method.
Right.
Are there hybrids between, let's say, DFT and ab initio?
There are, but they are sort of formulated in a different manner, because these QMMM methods are sort of formulated such that you treat the interactions explicitly. And this is possible by just writing down sort of a Hamiltonian for that and sort of going through all the terms in that Hamiltonian. If you combine DFT and ab initio, then the only way that has been worked out and that is functioning is an interpolation procedure, that you basically do sort of a high-level calculation on a small system, then a low-level calculation, QM both, you know, on the small system and the large system, and then you do an interpolation of the three results, basically, to...
It's not hybrid, really.
It's not really hybrid, it's an interpolation scheme, then, yeah. Of course, one could talk about QMMM for a long time, and I told Kurt already, I have given winter schools on that, so if there's some interest, I can sort of spend an hour, you know, for those who are interested, going through sort of the typical QMMM issues that arise. This is an offer just, you know, if you want to have it, I can do that anytime, because...
Yeah, I think people should keep it off their mind, but what you also could do is some wiki pages, there's a link to research material. Why don't you just give a few references there, and then people
I can do.
Contact you here, and they have a look at it or something.
So this is what I plan to do in terms of quantum mechanics framework, so to set, give the overall set of mind. I now have some transparencies to beef that up with actual work. I don't know time-wise or interest-wise whether we should do that or not, yeah?
Another 10 minutes or so would be...
Okay, I can start and you can stop me anytime, yeah?
Maybe you should have some time.
Is Thalen's non-existent?
Not really.
For me, it's more interesting
in tradition to think about myself. It's behind the other side.
So Kurt knows that we have at the Max Planck Institute every 2 or 3 years a committee coming from the outside to evaluate us, and then you have to give sort of an overview over your work. And this happened for us last year, and so I have just sort of taken now from that presentation about half of the slides, you know, just to show you a little bit, you know, of what has been going on in our group recently, last 3 years. So you are familiar with these methods now. So we use all these methods. We are also active in development at all these stages, even though, you know, our emphasis is on the large scale systems. Typical applications our group is for small molecules, spectroscopy, for transition metal compounds, catalysis, for electronically excited states, dynamics, and for enzymes, biocatalysis. These 4 points match up with these four methods.
For the transition metals, do you run into characteristic problems, or is this still okay?
It's still okay because we use what you've mentioned, effective core potentials. So the relativistic effects are largest for the core electrons.
That you do effectively.
That we do effectively. It's well-established technology since the 1980s or so. Yeah. So ab initio, low vibrational spectroscopy, going for accuracy. So what we do ab initio calculations, gold standard type, yeah, to get the potential energy surface and to get the dipole moment surface. We then do variational calculations for the nuclear motion, sort of a complete basis set thing now for nuclear, not electronic motion, to get the rho vibrational wave function and rho vibrational energies.
I don't know what rho vibration is.
Rotation vibration.
Okay. Thank you.
So, and then you combine this information, the dipole moment surface, get intensities, and get the spectrum simulation. So this is a straightforward ab initio approach, no fudging around. And I should stress, this is a numerically exact solution of the nuclear motion problem. You can do that, basically. You can merge that. So the decisive factor for the results is the quality of the potential energy surface. And if we use our usual gold standard, we get an accuracy of 5 wave numbers in the rho vibrational energy levels, which corresponds to milliEV. So that's the accuracy we get straight at the gold standard level. And then you worry what you need to get higher accuracy. And this is now going beyond heaven in my diagram. So basically you start from the gold standard and you go to higher order couple cluster terms, triples, quadruples, pentuples, you can do that nowadays if you really want to. The correlation we use at the gold standard level, only valence electron correlation, but the core electrons, you know, may differ a little bit in correlation, so we include core correlation. We include scalar relativistic effects from certain ways to do that. We include diagonal Born-Oppenheimer contributions. And what we have not done, but have done in other cases, is include spin orbit and quantum electrodynamics, which is always small for these things.
That sounds like
hell. Well, we try to push it, yeah? Yeah.
You really need beyond 5 inversion to meter of the cubes.
Talk with high-resolution spectroscopists. They are not impressed by 5 wave numbers. And now we've gone for one particular molecule, this one here. We have gone through these motions and doing all this additional work, you know. And this basically tells you that you are lucky at the gold standard level, because this is for now all sorts of levels, for all sorts of transitions in the vibrational spectrum. And you see that there is a lot of cancellation of these higher order terms. So if you really see this in ab initio sense, you see that, for example, the green stuff, core correlation, this can easily be 10 wave number effect on a rho vibrational level. But this is systematically varied, and you understand why, by higher order coupled cluster effects, when you go coupled cluster, the effects of quadruples and pentuples and so on.
Excuse me. Yeah? What does the zero mean in this?
So zero means we have corrections here, basically. Correction. So the size of the corrections, yeah. So if it were zero, it would be great, you know, no correction, yeah.
So it's experimental value.
No. We evaluate these higher level corrections ab initio, and we look how big they are in absolute value. And they are 2 wave numbers or 5 wave numbers or so, okay. So that we basically know what we've thrown out at the gold standard, what basically is needed still. And there you see lots of cancellations going on, so it's very hard to go beyond 5 wave number accuracy without including that stuff, because this 5 wave number accuracy always benefits from error cancellation. But you can do it, and we've done it for NH3, for example. And then you get indeed wave number accuracy. This is 10 to the minus 4 EV accuracy in the purely ab initio sense, no fudging. And you see high trend, the red spectra are from a database. That's high-resolution spectroscopy, what they get. And the green is what we've computed without fudging. And you see the match is, I think, essentially perfect, yeah? Not only position, but also intensity. And this also gives us confidence, you know, that we do the right thing for the right reason, because we converge our theoretical ab initio treatment as far as we can, and then we get there where gas phase high-resolution spectroscopists are, basically. And this applies to the rotational manifold, that's here around 100 to 200 wave numbers, but also very complicated overtone combination regions around more than 4,000 wave numbers. So we are doing something right here, basically. And what is it good for? Well, not really for chemistry, but here we have then computed some 3 million transitions, and the Hytran database from the experimentalist stops here. And so I would think these are very reasonable predictions, you know, for the higher end, because there's no reason why it should deteriorate much. And this may be useful for astrophysics, because people look at small dwarfs, exoplanets, and so on, trying to find out, you know, what's in the atmosphere. And what we can sort of produce on the computer is now hotline lists, just varying the temperature, and then predicting spectra that would be very hard to measure, I think, and that we claim are accurate, basically. So this is an example for sort of the first philosophy, ab initio, converging things to the end, and see, you know, how good we are. Second point, density functional methods. This is, for me, bread and butter computational chemistry, because this is something where the groups from the 4 experimental departments in our institute come to us and say, we've done this reaction, wonderful results, but we don't understand why. And so we then compute the mechanism of these reactions, transition states, intermediates, understanding what's going on by DFT methods, typically. Typical system size, 50 to 100 atoms, the model systems that we have. I've shown you one here, which is an asymmetric hydrogenation of some particular compound catalyzed by some chiral rhodium catalyst. That's the type of work that's interesting for our experimentalists. And you can get the product either as a image or the mirror image. And this is important to have enantioselectivity, that you can experimentally prepare just either the molecule or its mirror image, not both at the same time. And this has been a branch in chemistry and synthetic chemistry for the last 20 years. It's very popular, and people want to understand why. And so what you do is that you then compute the catalytic cycles. So association, you know, at the metal, and then you put in H2, you have rearrangements, and you do it for two manifolds, for the two possible ways of putting things together. And then you get two energy profiles, and then you look at the two energy profiles, and then you find that kinetically favored is the one which has initially the energetically less favorable complex. So the naive thing of chemists would be, we look, you know, what comes together, and then the complex that is most stable will give the predominant product. That would be thermodynamic control, essentially. And we have a case here where basically there are two ways of initial association, and the one that is less energetically favorable is associated with lower barriers and gives the predominant product. So you understand the mechanism, the outcome, in atomistic detail, why your reaction goes like it goes.
So you're not really doing dynamics at any point. You're just sort of solving for the electronic structure at various stages of the molecules coming together and then looking for just what energies are available?
That's the standard approach to do our transition state, geometry optimization, reaction pathways. But increasingly, we are doing actual dynamics on QM. I have an example of that later, yeah? And just to show you, you know, that we have many customers, you know, I don't go through the list, you know, people come with all sorts of problems to us. These were the things that were published when I gave the talk, and these were the reactions that we looked at when I was giving the talk, you know, which were still in progress. So this is everyday business in our institute, that we contribute by such computations to understanding of catalysis. Now the third one, semi-empirical methods. These are sort of out of favor in general, because you will do DFT whenever you can do DFT, because nowadays, you know, you can spend sort of the computing power, you know, to do a good DFT calculation. So in ground state chemistry, you will do semi-empirical work only if you've properly validated it, and then you're looking at very large systems. If you have 1,000 atoms of that kind, if you do, for example, QMM molecular dynamics, you use often in the QM part a semi-empirical method after you've convinced yourself that that makes sense. So if for very compute-intensive things in the ground state, you still use semi-empirical stuff. In the excited states, DFT is much weaker than in the ground state. So TD-DFT, and I say that, well, it's recorded, but I say nevertheless, I think TD-DFT has more problems than answers, because there are many excited state phenomena where TD-DFT is just not right, you know, and there are big efforts to remedy that, but I think either a CASPT2 ab initio, which runs out of steam, you know, pretty quickly, or semi-empirical MRCI has lots to offer there. And since many of you do dynamics, I thought I'd show you the part, you know, where we do excited state studies with this particular method, where we do excited state dynamics. And I've just listed here, you know, a few real systems that we had looked at, including something like GFP chromophores or, well, I think I have an example, adenine and DNA later on. So what we are doing there is non-adiabatic dynamics, because if you go vertically up to the excited state, then the wave packet basically sort of moves on the excited state surface and can sort of hop to the ground state, typically in the vicinity of conical intersections. And this mechanistic feature in photochemistry is something where von Oppenheimer breaks down. There was a question before that, you know. And so we have to do sort of an even balanced treatment of the nuclear and electronic degrees of freedom in this part of the surface. So what we are doing there is surface hopping dynamics, which was pioneered by John Tully, 1990. What you do there is you look at a swarm of independent trajectories that you initiate here. Each trajectory evolves on a single potential energy surface, can be more, S1, S2, whatever. And then you allow sudden hops, according to a stochastic criterion, between different potential energy surfaces. This is the usual expansion of the wave function. And this is the non-adiabatic coupling, which we have to compute as we go along. It is scalar product of the nuclear velocity times the non-adiabatic coupling matrix element, essentially Vibronic coupling. You solve basically this propagation problem as you go along on the potential energy surface. And then you basically see how the system evolves, how long it stays here, when it goes to the ground state, whether it sort of goes to other states. And I've tweaked, yeah?
Conical intersection, that was just a specific example you made, because I'm not aware of day in, day out, you see conical intersections.
Say again?
I mean, to have a conical intersection of these energy sources, I mean, that doesn't happen day in, day out.
It does. This is something that photochemists have realized over the last 20 years, that conical intersections are the mechanistic feature in fast excited state dynamics.
I just thought this is unique, special symmetries, all kinds of fancy
things
happening. That's why everyone is excited about graphene, like just graphene, because it has these things everywhere.
Conical intersections you find all over the place if you look at excited states. I mean, people are sometimes misled by the diatomic case, where there is crossings are forbidden, yeah? But as long as you have three atoms, or as soon as you have three atoms, you have conical intersections. And this is the mechanistic feature, you know, that is important, you know, for fast excited state dynamics all over the place. And you sometimes think, you know, excited states sort of in terms of exponential decay. That is sort of a natural way of thinking about it goes away. If you run these dynamics, you see that it's periodic, basically. And you can analyze, you know, the motions, the promoting vibrations that are behind that. So by these dynamic simulations, you get an idea, basically, what promotes, really, you know, going from one state to another one. And this particular case, cis-azobenzene, I guess you're not quite, so it's an N2, N double bond N, with two phenyls, two phenyl substituents. And in the cis case, so that is sort of a twisted system, and that can turn one way or the other in the dynamics. And the dynamics basically show that one way of twisting it is much favored over the other way of twisting it, which is determined by the underlying potential, of course. And this basically tells you that you have chirality in the mechanism, even in such fast femtosecond dynamics. Chirality meaning that clockwise turn is more favored over than anticlockwise turn.
How is a double N and two phenols? That's not even a chiral molecule, or am I missing something?
Well, think about it. I mean, if you just write it down, this would be the transform, which is planar, and it's not chiral. Now, if you do the cis form, there would be steric constraints if it were planar. So it twists out of planarity. And once it twists out of planarity, the angle is 55 degrees, the twist angle. Then you have a C2 axis, basically, that relates the two, and this means it's chiral. So it's a.
It could twist either way out of that constraint. Some molecules might twist this way, other
right.
molecules might twist that way.
And then when you excite that, you know, then how it twists to go back to the ground state, that is the message from these simulations, depends on the sense of direction how it twists. So one sense is favored over the other sense.
If you have a box of cis azobenzene, then you would have 50% like twisted like this and 50% twisted like that.
They would not be distinguishable. You would have to put them. You have to put them anywhere on the surface to distinguish that. There was a PRL article where cis azobenzene was put on the surface, and where these chiral effects were also seen experimentally. I can give you the literature. I think it goes astray a little bit now. Or?
I'm confused whether there's a genuine chirality, like a four-valent carbon, or whether this is a spontaneous symmetry breaking, which sometimes goes this and sometimes goes that.
There's more to chirality than tetravalent carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So this is helical chirality, which is actual chirality, which is maybe a rare case, yeah? But it's still chirality, yeah? Okay, we've also done these excited state dynamics for larger systems, monomeric adenine and DNA strands. And this is now a multi-scale approach, QMM approach, where we've treated one adenine at the QM level and have done that in a single strand of DNA oligomer model and in a double strand. And if you look at the gas phase and have adenine in water, then you find, you know, that there are two major decay channels. One decay channel basically has an NH2 group going much out of the plane to get to the conical intersection, and the other one has an H2 just going out of the plane pretty much. And this is the preferred channel with out of plane NH2 in the gas phase, in water, and in single strand DNA. But if you go to two double-strand DNA, this NH2 group is sort of engaged in a hydrogen bond, in the Watson-Crick DNA hydrogen bond. And this is enough, basically, to hinder the dynamics in that one channel. And then the other channel takes over and wins out. So that by going from a single strand to a double strand DNA, we basically have a change in mechanism of how the photochemistry works. So things like that, you can do lots of nice dynamic studies of such systems.
Are you in QM just one adenine in the chain?
That's a limitation, of course. We should do it with two and three also. That's in the works, yeah. Exitons and so on. Yeah. Now, last point would be QMMM. I started with the adenine example on that already. And so what we do, I mentioned that before, active site QM, as accurate as you want to, outer part MM, outer subsystem, and then you basically have electronic embedding where the active site feels the polar environment, basically, by terms in the Hamiltonian. Van der Waals is included. And you have to do something about, you know, when you have to cut at the QMMM boundary, which I would could talk about at another stage. Then you need program development for that. And what is being done there is that all the QMMM generic stuff, this is in our implementation sort of central control modules that we keep have written once and for all. And then you can hook up your favorite QM and your favorite MM code so that you can basically handle all types of QMMM combinations. Whenever in chemistry you have something where you have an active site and something around, this type of approach will work. It's very modular. And what we usually do, and you can read that in this Angewandte article, is that we have 10 to 40,000 atoms that we model for enzyme biocatalysis. That's the enzyme in a droplet of water. 50 to 100 atoms for QM, standard DFT typically, standard force field as MM, electrostatic embedding, QMMM boundary link atom treatment. And the normal thing is still that we look at energy profiles, reaction pathways, locate transition states, and so on. And this, of course, is dangerous in an enzyme because there is not a single transition state like in small molecule chemistry, but because of the conformational complexity of the enzymes, there are many. So what we do in a poor man's treatment basically would be to look at 5 or 10 snapshots, basically, just to see, you know, representative transition states, how much, you know, the results vary with the protein environment, because all these are local optimizations. And so basically you have to make sure that you don't miss out on things.
When you say snapshots, you're actually doing evolving in time
then? Yeah, doing in the setup phase, we do a classical MD, and then we take snapshots out of that after equilibration, blah, 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 and then pick these as starting points for the QMMM. And then recent improvements that we have done is using high-level correlated ab initio methods as QM components, that's for accuracy. We are able to use polarizable force fields in a polarized embedding once the community gets these straightened out, I think, yeah. We have all the technology available to do free energy profiles, to do proper sampling through molecular dynamics methods. It's costly, so we only do it, you know, if we are forced to. We have extended the whole thing to excited state QMM modeling. I showed you an example before that, adenine in DNA. We have developed three-layer QMMM continuum approaches where we sort of have a continuum layer at the very outside to capture long-range electrostatics, etc. And we've also used it for quantum refinement of protein crystal structures. I still have now six, seven slides of enzyme reactions, but I think you are saturated by now. And so I would probably stop at that point unless you want to really see it.
In your combined approach of QM and MM, so you have some, so all these codes are developed by your group, and how is the structure?
I mean, QMMM, the history. It was first suggested by Arya Warshall in 1976. Then it was dormant for 15 years, yeah? And in the 1990s, many groups have started on QMMM developments. And there are essentially three strategies how to do it. Once you start from a QM program and you add some MM functionality, or you start from an MM program and add some QM functionality, or you do it in a more even-handed manner, that's the way that we did it, that you have a modular structure where you put your efforts into the interface, and then you hook up programs as they are via very simple interfaces. And so we are just having this modular ChemShell program, which serves our purposes, but I'm not claiming that that is the best or the only one. You know, there are others around also. Yeah.
But these code are all quite structured.
I mean, what we do basically is in the interface, we have we give the QM and the MM program Cartesian coordinates, and we take back an energy and a gradient. And then the central modules do something with the energy and the gradient. Geometry optimization, molecular dynamics, what have you, you know.
What's the back and forth talk between these regions? So let's say you could start with an old atom classical simulation of that site, then you replace the classical reactive site by some QM treatment. Let's say this, the QM says, oh, I'd rather like to be in a funny different conformation. Would that propagate out to the classical region?
Well, when we do geometry optimization, we usually, I mean, what you do in practice is we have 20,000 atoms, say. We do a full classical MD on that. And then we pick a snapshot. And then we typically freeze the 19,000 outer atoms and optimize the 1,000 inner atoms, which is QM region plus a few layers of MM, and optimize that in order to get reaction paths, transition states, and the like. And so in that sense, I think we are flexible enough that we don't have to go back to the outer 19,000 atoms. We could if we have a reasonable doubt that we have missed something.
But there is back. I mean, the question is, does the outer classical environment really just provide a boundary condition for quantum, or is there back talk going on in some way?
Well, there is talk in one way, that the quantum feels the charges from the outside.
Yes.
And we have polarized embedding. We have all the machinery there that we can sort of backtalk to the MM part in terms of polarizabilities. But this would require, of course, to be consistent, the polarizable force field, which is in good shape. And these polarizable force fields, I mean, we've published stuff on that. We have done, for example, solvent problems, where we've teamed up with the Gromos people, Wilfried van Gunstrum at ETH, and where we have taken their polarizable force field for dimethyl ether, and have seen, you know, there we have done this backtalking, basically. What we would love to have is sort of a protein force field that is as standard as amber or charm that is fully polarizable, because then we could use this technology sort of in a more even-handed manner, also backtalking to the MM, yeah. But this would make sense more if you just have a polarizable force field.
It might not just backtalk by polarizing the outer environment, it might backtalk by changing dihedrals and...
Ah, yeah. I'm talking right now only about the electronic structure part, backtalk, because separate from that, we have the way how we explore the potential energy surface. And that backtalk is there anyway.
Oh, okay, good. That's what
I want. That backtalk is there anyway, yeah?
Okay.
Regardless whether we do geometry optimization or MD. When we do MD, we typically do a sort of 10,000 atoms MD and just leave the outer water shell constant to have some boundary.
In that case, if they do talk back and forth, are you worried in any sense that since the classical free energy is lower than the quantum free energy, that necessarily linking these two levels, there is some offset of free energy, and it might, or is this not a problem?
We have not been worried about that because the QMMM method is constructed such that you have one single potential energy surface for the whole system. I mean, there are the active side is probably closer to reality than the classical side, but we technically still have one single potential energy surface on which we can do MD or whatever you want. Yeah. Is that not answering your question?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. But in an extreme case where you could actually exchange particles between these regions, even if you have an optimal classical region and an optimal quantum region, as soon as you get it, then a particle could say, oh, I'm going to go to the classical region because there my free energy is lower.
Okay. I should point that out. I mean, adaptive QMMM is certainly an interesting issue which we haven't tackled. I mean, Kurt has tackled it in his group to some extent, I think.
Very simple.
Yeah.
Well, that's an extreme case, but even if you can't exchange particles, is the mismatch in free energy maybe a problem? Because the fluctuations here versus the fluctuations there, the system could decide to do a different transformation so that something that fluctuates rather fluctuates on this side than on that side of the boundary, thereby having a different...
I cannot really argue that that is not a problem, but we have not noticed problems of that kind, you know? In principle, this might be a problem, yeah. And of course, you know, if you really want to QMMMD, one should think about adaptive procedures to do that, sort of going in and out. But you have to correct me, Kurt. I mean, I have not seen something that is, you know, at the sort of enzyme level, really practical. I mean, Don Truller has suggested some stuff, but this is, I think, impractical. You know, lots of work, and I don't believe in that.
There's nothing practical
about it. So it would be good to have something like that. Yeah. So most of the work that we are doing is actually geometry optimization work on the enzyme. And you see, the best problems for us are when you have a relatively rigid active site, that you don't have dynamic problems, because then the electronic structure of the active site determines the outcome of the problem, yeah? And so in that case, we can basically get by with reaction path geometry optimization and so on. We have tested free energy calculation on a handful of enzymes where we've done the full thing, yeah? QMM, MDE, thermodynamic integration, umbrella sampling, and all that. And there we found that when we have sort of local changes in the reaction, like a proton transfer local, or an SN2 reaction, or fluorination, or things like that, where we don't have large-scale changes in the environment, then it works out fine. The free energy corrections are very small then. We had one case where it was a bit larger, of course, made mutase, which is a pericyclic reaction, where there was an experimental value for the entropic effects on the barrier of 2.7 kcal, and we got 2.2 kcal. So this is, for us, you know, was better than expected, I would say. But free energy is something, you know, which we will see more and more. And that's also where semi-empirical comes in again. Because that's so expensive, you know, you need millions and millions of energy and gradient evaluations, and then DFT even becomes too slow for that. And so semi-empirical can capture such effects reasonably well.
There might be a difference between your small molecule catalysis and if you have really big biomolecules where they're overall wobbling around, is a part of whether they're catalytically active or not.
Yeah. I mean, there are parts in the catalytic cycle of biocatalysis where we cannot make statements about, you know. If you have large-scale motion, I wouldn't do QMMM. We do something classical, yeah. So QMMM is good if you have an electronic event that is pretty localized in an active site. And then you can distinguish between different reaction pathways. I'll show you three slides. Just to give you an idea. We looked at this molybdenum enzyme, for example. Just molybdenum as the catalytic center, with some sulfur and oxygen around, you know, and some junk here. And then you have here the reactions and oxidation, which is not so important. And so what we did there is there were two mechanisms basically suggested on the basis of model calculations in the gas phase, a one-step reaction, a two-step reaction. And we looked at a third reaction where basically there is a conserved glutamate residue which can pick up a proton here from this OH group that is attached to the molybdenum, making here an O-. And this O- is then much more able to form this intermediate by nucleophilic attack at the carbonyl-carbon atom. And then you have a hydride shift to the product. And if you go through the motions, basically, and look at the barriers, then you see that the two previously supposed mechanisms have high barriers. This is a low barrier. So the Lewis-based catalyzed mechanism with involvement of one particular active site residue wins by a large margin. And so we are confident that that is the right mechanism for that enzyme. And we have many more examples of that kind. This is just a very transparent one. You can write down three or four different mechanisms, and then you do the QMM calculations and decide, you know, what is the right mechanism. And we have done this also for a more complicated case for xanthine oxidase itself, where you have many more possibilities here. And there I think we have nailed down the right mechanism for xanthine oxidation, which is important medically because this is at the root of hyperuremia, I think is the word, gout, of that disease. So that might help, you know, knowing the mechanism to find out new inhibitors or something like that, yeah? I have five more slides, which I won't show.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, last week.